And welcome to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. And seems like we're missing our opening, our bumper music here. So we'll just say hi. Welcome to our program. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And 6 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock here on the Pacific West Coast. 6 minutes after the hour of noon on the East Coast. 6 minutes after the hour. And Zach, I just lost my call screen software. Somebody just popped up wire ready on our thing here, so I need you to please put David Sirota on the air for me. We've got a fill-in board up, and apparently somebody's messing with the computer over there. David Sirota, in fact, okay, I just got it back. I just bumped that person out. David Sirota's with us. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Good, good. Sorry for all the technical problems. David, the RNC and Howard Dean the RNC in particular is promulgating what seems to me to be both a myth and a lie. And Howard Dean, I think, tried to put it to bed this weekend when on Late Edition with Wolf Blitzer, he just came right out and said it. Let me just play this clip for you.
There are no Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff. Not one. Not one single Democrat. Every person named in this scandal is a Republican. Every person in under investigation is a Republican. Every person indicted is a Republican. This is a Republican finance scandal. There is no evidence that Jack Abramoff ever gave any Democrat any money. And we've looked through all those FEC reports to make sure that's true. I know the Republican National Committee would like to get the Democrats involved in this. They're scared. They should be scared. They haven't told the truth. They have misled the American people. And now it appears they're stealing from Indian tribes. The Democrats are not involved in this.
We're talking with David Sirota. DavidSirota.com, his website. David, did you see that this weekend?
I did.
Yeah, I was amazed. Wolf Blitzer, his mouth dropping open. He was absolutely speechless there for a moment. He's like, is what Howard Dean said true?
It is. It's absolutely true. I think what the Republican Party is trying to do is trying to broaden it into whether Democrats receive money from Indian tribes and saying that basically if they got money from any tribes that Jack Abramoff ultimately went to work for and actually looks like he stole a lot of money from, that means that Democrats are somehow involved in this. I mean, here's the problem for the Republicans, is that the key problem here is not whether you took money. Okay, I mean, politicians, unfortunately, in a system that forces politicians to raise money, politicians take money from all sorts of folks. The issue is whether there was a quid pro quo, in whether the politicians in question did something after they got the money, did something for the money. Now, there's two reasons why that's a problem for
this is
Republicans.
This is called bribery, right?
Right, it's called bribery. There's two reasons why that's a problem for the Republicans. One, the Democrats are not really in much of a position right now to do anything. I mean, they can get money, but they can't really pass bills. I mean,
They can help. I mean, there is some legislation that doesn't enjoy popular support. Things like the bankruptcy bill, for example. They had to have a few Democrats on board because they had a few Republicans who defected.
Well, you're absolutely right.
Or CAFTA.
I guess what I'm saying is this, is that it's harder for Democrats to actually do anything. And more importantly, there is no evidence that Democrats did anything in return for the money. And there's a huge amount of evidence that Republicans did a lot in return for the money. I mean, out here where I live in Montana, Senator Conrad Burns, he took $160,000 from Jack Abramoff, and the newspapers out here have recently written stories about how he switched his position on a given issue and then how he switched his votes on given issues. That is what really is at the center of this, vote buying and essentially bribery.
Yeah, is it going to be called bribery? Are we going to see prosecutions of Republican legislators?
Well, I mean, I think that remains to be seen whether we'll see prosecutions. I think if there are prosecutions, they will be bribery. I mean, that's what Jack Abramoff essentially pled guilty to, trying to bribe public officials. And I do think you cut to an important point, Tom. I think that, you know, one thing that people haven't talked about, I'm not exactly quite sure why, is that basically if what Jack Abramoff did is illegal, then essentially almost everything that goes on in politics is illegal. I mean, basically, you know, the idea that politicians are feigning outrage and the media is feigning outrage that, oh my gosh, a lobbyist gave money to a member of Congress and they went and did something. I mean, this is an indictment of our entire system.
Yeah. And yet we have this fundamental problem here, David Sirota, davidsirota.com, your website, that the Supreme Court has ruled repeatedly over the last 25, 30 years that corporations have rights of persons, rights of personhood, and therefore they have the right to be involved in political action, in political committees and political activities. And, I mean, that's why McCain-Feingold had to basically regulate politicians instead of regulating corporations.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that, then you go into how the hypocrisy of how you basically, the law sees corporations now as people, gives them the right of people, but then doesn't give them the responsibilities of people.
Right.
In other words, I mean, you have corporations regularly dodging taxes. They commit, heinous crimes, don't really get prosecuted for them in a way that a human being would get prosecuted. So essentially, you're right. The system is entirely rigged to give corporations all of the rights of basically personhood and citizenship and none of the responsibilities.
We're talking with David Sirota. He's the author of a new book titled Hostile Takeover. It'll be released in the spring of this year. People can find it online right now, David?
Yeah, that's right. You can find it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Powell's, wherever.
Great, and pre-order it. And which I have, this is going to be a great book. I'm really looking forward to it. In fact, I'd like to speak very briefly in the few minutes we have left here, David Sirota, with you about one of the topics that I know is near and dear to your heart and is to mine as well, and that is the essential corruption of the Democratic Party going on right now. We have a battle going on for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. Please speak to that for a moment.
Yeah, well, there's the party on, if you look at every single issue that the party has dealt with in Congress, beyond the war in Iraq, where I think the party is just doesn't have the guts to stand up and articulate a real position. I think when you look at the economic issues, this party right now is really in the throes of deciding who it really stands for. I mean, if you look at every major piece of economic legislation that came down the pike last year, the class action bill, the bankruptcy bill. All sorts of other bills, the energy bill, which gave away tax breaks to big oil companies. If you look at the actual votes, you go beyond the rhetoric and you look at the actual votes, the Democratic Party in Congress was entirely split and in many cases supported the big money position. And that really speaks to the idea that you're absolutely right, that the Democratic Party really hasn't decided whether it is going to be the party of the working class and of middle class people, or whether it's going to basically be a little better but still the same arm of a one party, corporate run government.
And really, the Democratic Leadership Council or committee is right out there at the front of this.
Absolutely. I mean, they basically, for listeners, the Democratic Leadership Council is a corporate funded institution that basically purports to speak for Democrats. I'm talking about corporate funded, funded by Philip Morris, funded by Enron, all the big players, okay? And they basically put out material and get into the press purporting to speak for Democrats, urging and pressuring the Democratic Party not to take serious positions on the fundamental economic issues like wages, like trade, like taxes, all sorts of these issues. And basically what it does is you have essentially a sort of a corporate infestation of the party. Now, I should say one thing that I'm optimistic about is that I really do think now more than ever there are more and more Democrats who are finding their voice, courageous Democrats, to say enough is enough. We really need to basically stop trying to be like the corporate Republican Party and start trying to define a new politics.
Well, and in fact, as you see in your state, isn't Brian Schweitzer your governor there?
Absolutely.
I mean, you've got progressive Democrats who are just absolutely kicking butt all across the United States. They're doing a great job, and they're bringing in red states and conservative areas.
Yeah, that's something that it's very hard to get across to basically the Washington political establishment.
Those who listen to Bob Shrum.
Right. The idea that you can run as a populist progressive in very, very red states and red districts and you can win. I mean, there was a story in Business Week this week talking about how Democrats are basically, unfortunately, the Democratic Party establishment is looking to candidates in House races that have only a business background and basically are quote unquote moderate. Now, I should say, one of the big things that we have to realize is you have to remember, every time somebody uses the phrase quote-unquote moderate or quote-unquote centrist, a red flag should go up in your head, because really what that is a euphemism for corporate conservative.
That's right, for Republican light. David Sirota, davidsirota.com, his website. David, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And for the great work you're doing. You are writing such great stuff, and I look forward to reading your book, Hostile Takeover. It's a Tom Hartman radio program, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Walk that walk, talk that talk, walk that walk.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, indeed, walk that walk, talk that talk. Tom Hartman here with you. Small Dog Electronics bringing you this program this hour. 1-800-511-MAX, their phone number, 511-MACS. Smalldog.com, the website, the latest iPods and all things Macintosh, all things computer. Give them a call, 1-800-511-MAX. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com will get you there. In the 50 years that Grant Goodman had known and corresponded with a colleague in the Philippines, writes Brock Meeks on MSNBC, their chief Washington correspondent, he had never had any reason to suspect that their friendship was anything but spectacularly ordinary. Here's this guy. He's an 81-year-old retired professor of history from the University of Kansas. For 50 years, this guy has been corresponding with a friend of his in the Philippines who must also be in his 80s by now. And now he gets a letter from his friend in the Philippines that has been opened and resealed with a strip of dark green tape bearing the words, "Buy Border Protection," and carrying the official Homeland Security seal. Goodman told MSNBC.com in a phone interview, "I had no idea Homeland Security would open personal letters. That's why I alerted the media. I thought it should be known publicly that this is going on." He says, "I was shocked, and there was a certain degree of disbelief in the beginning. I think I must be under some kind of surveillance." Now, here's an 81-year-old retired history professor under surveillance. Goodman is no stranger to mail snooping, notes MSNBC, Brock Meeks on MSNBC. As an officer during World War II, he was responsible for reading all outgoing mail of the men in his command and censoring any passages that might provide clues to his unit's position. He says, "But we didn't do it as clumsily as they've done it, I can tell you that." He noted with no small irony in his voice, "Isn't it funny that this doesn't appear to be any kind of surreptitious effort here?" Now, they're in our face. They're saying to us, "We've taken over. We'll bug you all we want. We'll listen in." Christian Amanpour, the wife of Jamie Rubin, the guy who stood in for John Kerry throughout the debates at the Bush administration, are they bugging her? We don't know. NBC, Andrea Mitchell, asks the question. NBC's official position, there's an ongoing investigation. But, I mean, this is just absolutely strange. John Mohan, a spokesman, says, "We've had this authority since before the Department of Homeland Security was created." Well, it gets even stranger. 56% of Americans, of course, now in this latest AP poll, and I'm amazed it would be 99% if we were still teaching civics in America, if American school children of all ages had to know the Constitution. But 56% want a court okay for any kind of wiretapping. And then we got John Yoo. John Yoo, the guy who publicly argued that there's no law preventing President Bush from basically taking the powers of a king. This is absolutely amazing. And John Yoo was in a debate with Doug Cassells. Doug Cassells is an advocate for, what would you call it? He's a Notre Dame professor, a law professor at Notre Dame, and an advocate for international human rights. That's how he's defined, Doug Gissell. And he says, you know, if the president decides that he's got to torture somebody, including crushing the testicles of the person's child, is there no law that can stop him? You. There's no treaty. Cassell, there's also no law by Congress. That's what you wrote in that August 2002 memo. You. I think it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that. Get it? This is the guy who wrote the policy. You. He wrote the policy. Well, here, in his own words.
If the president deems that he's got to torture somebody, including by crushing the testicles of the person's child, there is no law that can stop that. No treaty. And also no law by Congress. That's what you wrote in the August 2002 memo.
I think it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that.
It's up to... Bush's Rex? I mean, have we gone that far? Is it its absolute presidential power? And I'm telling you, the two brains behind this doctrine of what's called the unitary presidency, John Yoo, the guy who's just a law professor at Berkeley, who wrote all these papers for the Bush administration right after 9/11, all these position statements that started us down this road of torture, and Sam Alito, who back in 1986 was making this argument for the Reagan administration. Sam Alito. And they're going to start the hearings on him, I believe in all probability this week. And if this isn't at the top of the list, I mean, this is incredible. This is absolutely incredible how far these guys will go and say, no, the Constitution, we don't need no stinking Constitution power. The president has absolute power. I'm sorry, the president doesn't have absolute power. This is a constitutionally limited democratic republic in which we live. It is not a kingdom. It never has been. It never will be. God willing. And I'm telling you, the conservative position that you is advocating, that Bush is advocating, this conservative position, this is not new. This has been going on since the founding of this republic. Share a little correspondence between Adams and Jefferson with you about it after this break, and then we'll take your calls. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harkin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least, an independent judiciary, fair elections. Welcome back to our program. George W. Bush had breakfast with Sam Scalito this morning. And the Democrats are a little concerned about this guy. Pat Leahy, who is chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, says Alito will have to show that he'll be an effective check on government overreaching. The hearing's going on right now, apparently, by the way. He said Bush did not help his cause by pulling out Harriet Myers, in the face of criticism from what Pat Leahy calls an extreme faction of the Republicans. Yeah, well said. This from NBC 10 News, by the way. Leahy said the top court is the ultimate check and balance in our system. He said independence is crucial. Dick Durbin, another Democrat, is concerned. Sandra Day O'Connor is the justice who's being replaced here. And he says, replacing her with a right winger will truly tip the balance of the scales of justice in America. And Charles Schumer intends to bring up the $64,000 question. He's going to toss Alito's quote right back at him. He's going to say, do you still, and then he's going to quote Alito's own words. And I quote from Sam Alito, personally believe very strongly that the Constitution does not protect a right to abortion, end quote. And Charles Schumer is going to say, do you still personally believe very strongly that? And that will be an interesting one to see him wiggle out of. In the meantime, we just discovered this over at Daily Kos that last Thursday, while we were sleeping, actually not while we were sleeping, but out of view of all the rest of us here, over at the White House, they had what they called a moot court session. Now, what this is kind of legal slang for, you know, let's practice. You have, you know, for example, if you're an attorney and you're going to go into court with a defendant, and you practice, you know, you rehearse the defendant. You ask them the questions that you expect the prosecution to ask, and, you know, if they answer the wrong way, you say, hey, you know, now here's how you should answer that kind of thing, okay? Well, you know, the gang of 14, these 14 guys who said that they will prevent a filibuster, they're going to be the moderates. One of them, Lindsey Graham, the Republican, participated last Thursday at the White House in coaching Alito in how he should respond to the Senate. And this, I mean, this is, can you imagine? I mean, you know, this is like the equivalent of the judge hanging out with you over the weekend saying, here's how to give me the right answers. Because Lindsey Graham's going to be one of the judges. He's going to be one of the senators who's going to vote on whether or not Alito is going to be on the United States Supreme Court. And not only that, he's part of the gang of 14. I mean, this is just way over the top. This is just way over the top. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Dan in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. I'm so glad that I'm a first-time caller.
Well, thanks for calling.
I'm sorry?
Thank you for doing that.
And I thank you for doing what you're doing. I am a Christian white male who is a Democrat, who does support the Democrat platform. And that's because that I believe everybody is created equal in God's sight. And my so-called Christian friends, the right-wingers and all them, they are a disgrace to sit there and use God as their political platform. We as Democrats need to get together. And we have got to get on the phones. We got to get our troops marching here, because I guarantee you the religious right people are out there, and the Christian conservatives are out there.
Yeah, and in fact, we saw them this weekend, you know, with their whole Justice Sunday thing held in a church which had received over $1 million in money from the Bush administration in these so-called faith-based funds, and you know, Rick Santorum and these guys. Oh yeah, we're going to do whatever it takes. Jerry Falwell saying this is the culmination of a 30-year campaign for the religion, you know, for the theocrats to take over the country.
Don't they understand that Ralph Reed was a Christian? He was involved with Christian Coalition. He was the president, I believe.
Yeah.
He also worked for Pat Robertson. I hope and pray that these other people that call themselves Christians will open their eyes up and they will vote in a good way. This president and this vice president, and I call it the machine up there in Washington, I mean, just like what you were saying, I mean, that's scary that a senator is going to be one of these that's going to have the final, or not final say, but one of the votes. And I just hope that the Democrats will stay strong and vote against this man, this Alito guy. I took a political science course in college, and I love politics. And I'm out there all the time talking to people and everything else in college, these young people and so forth. A lot of young people, after the last election, think, why should I vote? Because we did a poll at one of the colleges. And I said, this is why you should vote, right here.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the bottom line. These are the key issues of our times. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Mike in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I really don't want to change the subject because this should be the focus of everybody's attention. I think this is clearly the most important thing that's going on, and everyone should be paying close attention and watching.
I have a feeling there's a butt coming here.
Yeah, but I wanted to ask you, at the same time they slipped out Paul Bremer saying that they genuinely did not believe that in Iraq there would be an insurgency after we invaded.
Right, yeah, and it's okay for you to change the subject, Mike, by the way. Let me just say, because one of the problems that we have in the United States, is, particularly with our network news, is that if there's a big story, it eclipses everything else, and then the everything else very often is the stealing of democracy. You know, Bremer said that. He said, we never expected an insurgency, and it's like the entire anti-war movement all over the planet. I mean, you had more people on the streets, the largest outpouring of people in the history of the world against the war, against George W. Bush invading Iraq. You had the UN refusing to give him authorization. You had, it was incredible. And the whole basis for, you know, most of the people in the anti-war movement wasn't, we're absolute pacifists. I think the vast majority of these people in World War II would have been, you know, in the first in line to sign up to go fight against Hitler. Instead, it was, this is crazy. You're going to invade this country that represents no threat to us, and then you're going to end up, you know, as Colin Powell said, you break it, you own it. You're going to have to play police force there. And guess what? People don't like to be occupied in their own countries. It ain't never worked.
And, I mean, furthermore, if you had asked me before this whole war started, I could have told you there would be an insurgency.
They're
blatantly lying, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yeah, Bremer is I can't speak for Bremer. I mean, maybe Bremer never expected an insurgency, but certainly it was discussed in the halls of the White House. I mean, absolutely. Yeah, this is just over the top, absolutely over the top. Phil in Tampa Bay. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. As someone who is applying for jobs online, I'm finding that there seems to be two standards. The nominee for Supreme Court, Alito, says that,
Alito.
Alito, okay.
Yeah. Alito is the old mayor of San Francisco.
Oh, you're right. Anyway, when he says, well, you know, when I was applying, you know, for a job with the Reagan administration, you know, I said that stuff about abortion because, well, you know, it's just a job, you know, it's just a job application.
Right.
In other words, implying, hey, you can lie on a job application. It's perfectly fine.
Right. But I wouldn't lie before the United States Senate because I don't lie. Right. Yeah.
But this is
we're supposed to believe this.
Standard. I applied for I have a background in medical sales, and I applied for a company involved in selling electrosurgery. And it says they're going to do a credit check, got to take a drug test. They want to know every date, when you started, when you completed. They want to know everything in the world about you just to even be considered.
Right.
So we got one standard for the everyday Joe when he applies for a job. And God help you if you don't, you know, meet the expectation, every single expectation of the
yeah,
company.
And as they're doing their credit check, they can look at it to such a micro level that they'll know whether or not you've ever subscribed to a porn site, for example. I mean, you know, it's incredible.
Well,
absolutely incredible.
I haven't done that, but this guy says, well, what the heck, it was just a job interview for a job with the White House. You can lie on something like that. That's nothing.
Right. Yeah. Phil, you've defined another one of the essential issues here. I mean, these guys are just, you know, whatever it takes. It's all about power. Will in Brea, California. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Truth teller, how's it going?
Hey, I'm fine, Will. What's on your mind?
Way cool. I was wondering, I wanted to ask you a question. You will tell me the truth. Is Nazi-like fascist a fair statement of these people, and do we wait until they prove it to everybody before we take action on this?
Well, I'm reluctant to use the word Nazi because the Nazis were a cult.
Nazi-like.
Yeah. The word fascist I have no problem using because, you know, Mussolini and Franco were fascists. And when Mussolini invented the word fascism, he said very clearly it's the merging of corporate and state interests. And that's definitely what John Roberts is all about. That's definitely what George W. Bush is all about. The Nazis, though, I mean, were psychopathic mass murderers. They gave fascists a bad name.
Mein Führer is getting really close, isn't it?
Well, yeah, tragic. You know, increasingly we're seeing things taken from the playbook of the Nazis, but I just think it's very dangerous to make those kinds of absolute parallels because it diminishes our credibility. Although we do have concentration camps now, we are building a death camp down in Guantanamo Bay, which has all of Europe flipped out for putting to death any guys who are convicted of death penalty sentences in these hearings that they're going to be having. There are some scary parallels. The Reichstag fire, the Parliament fire is what brought Hitler to power and 9/11 and Bush. And I mean, all these stuff, yes. But still, I'd say, yeah, fascists, yes, Nazis, no. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Gave him the old razzle dazzle. You razzle dazzled them. You gave him an act with.
Global warming is an issue that my administration is very concerned about, deeply. Deeply, in a deep kind of concerned way. It's I start my day and I think about the warming of the globe and how we can get it warmer.
Cut.
You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle dazzle them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Adam in Houston, Texas, on the line. Hey, Adam, welcome to the program.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. What's up?
Well, I was just calling in to say, you know, with the whole Tom, news about Tom DeLay deciding that he's not going to, you know, seek to regain his majority seat, you know, we seem to have forgotten how all of that got started. And I remember, you know, it all came to the forefront when, you know, a lesser-known congressman, Chris Bell from Texas, also filed the ethics complaint against DeLay. And everyone on all the talk shows and all the written media, all the print media, said, you know, it wouldn't go anywhere and that it would just get swept under the rug. And, you know, it raised so much attention about the issue.
Well, I think it would have been swept under the rug if it hadn't been for Ronnie Earle.
Right, but, you know, it was...
Tom DeLay went to the point of firing from the Ethics Committee his own Republican colleagues and
absolutely
putting on Doc, what's-his-name, from Washington State in charge of the Ethics Committee, who was a DeLay toady.
Right, right, and also...
Doc
changed,
Hastings.
You know, had the rules changed so that if he was indicted, he wouldn't have to resign, and then after...
Right.
The
I mean, you know, class, yeah, he changed the judge, he changed the jury, he changed the laws... for all practical purposes, that, you know, that had to do with what he could do. And but it wasn't until, you know, Ronnie Earle came along and actually indicted him with a criminal offense that things got real for him. And that's the thing. That's why I think that this Abramoff thing has the potential to be a real problem for the Democrats. For the Republican Party. And,
right. You know, but it was when Chris Bell filed that ethics complaint, you know, the Democrats wouldn't come near him with a 10-foot stick. They were, you know, totally scared that there would be retribution against Democrats.
I know. And I agree with you, Adam. The Democrats have to learn from Chris Bell's guts. I mean, you know, it, absolutely. And in fact, I think that what we're seeing is the beginning of that with Howard Dean here this weekend Late Edition with Wolf Blitzer.
There are no Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff. Not one single Democrat. Every person named in this scandal is a Republican. Every person in under investigation is a Republican. Every person indicted is a Republican. This is a Republican finance scandal. There is no evidence that Jack Abramoff ever gave any Democrat any money. And we've looked through all those FEC reports to make sure that's true. I know the Republican National Committee would like to get the Democrats involved in this. They're scared. They should be scared. They haven't told the truth. They have misled the American people. And now it appears they're stealing from Indian tribes. The Democrats are not involved in this.
The Democrats are not involved in this. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Help me be more optimistic. With this administration, do you think it can be weakened, if not brought down, like Nixon's? Because Nixon, if I recall, didn't have a rubber stamp Congress like this administration.
That's right. The Democrats controlled, I'd have to go back and look, at least the House during the Nixon administration, and I think they had the Senate as well during the latter part of his administration when Watergate happened.
But
they also had Republicans voting with them, you know, I don't recall if it was a minority or a majority, but it was like within one vote, one way or the other, of the Republicans on the House committee that recommended the Articles of Impeachment, voted for impeachment of Richard Nixon.
And, well, did Nixon have a boogeyman like 911?
No. Well, he had the Vietnam War going, and he was trying to turn it into one.
Yeah,
He kept saying, all these people, they're anti-American. They want us to lose in Vietnam. We've got to have victory, you know, all this kind of, he was trotting out all the same old things. No, I think that, in the context of impeachment, if we want to see George W. Bush impeached, and I frankly think it's politically a good idea to have him impeached. Number one, I believe he's committed high crimes and misdemeanors that are impeachable on multiple levels. And number two, even if it's not successful, and it never has been. I mean, Andrew Johnson, he wasn't convicted in the Senate. Bill Clinton was not convicted in the Senate. But what it does is it ties him up for a couple of years and doesn't allow him to continue to take apart this country.
That's right. I would like to see, at least weaken him.
That's right.
And I agree with you that we do have to take over one of the houses. And
but I think that the discussion, Bonnie, I think that if we spend a lot of time talking about impeachment, this is where I agree with Bernie Sanders on this, even though I disagree with him about impeachment. If we spend a lot of time between now and November, the elections, talking about impeachment, then we're not going to be focusing our effort on getting Democrats elected.
Right.
We need to be
getting our message out.
That's right. We need
to
be putting a proactive, positive vision for America that's going to get Democrats elected so that the Democrats can take back the House and the Senate. And then after November, when we've got Democratic control of the House and Senate, need to be talking about, okay, now let's hold these guys accountable now that we actually have the subpoena power that goes with majority control of either of those bodies.
I have one last point.
Sure.
The Nixon era had a large, more enlightened, liberal middle class, and I know I'm being reductive for brevity here, but just oppose the 70s culture and economy with the culture of white male corporate Christian dominance that has found sanctuary in the macho boy president. I don't remember Nixon having a seemingly large, disciplined army of anxious economic and cultural warriors.
Well, to a large extent, actually, he did. You remember his speeches about, the silent majority?
Uh-huh.
And I mean, this was the era in which the Falwells and whatnot were first starting to organize.
Yeah.
In fact, Jerry Falwell on Sunday said Sam Alito getting on the court will be the culmination of a 30-year effort, which I guess really takes us back to Reagan.
The rest of us can overcome the corporate-owned government machine, I guess.
There you go. Well said. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania, thank you for the call and for the hopeful comments. I think that there's tremendous hope. I see Americans awakening from coast to coast, and we all need to be participating in it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Congressman Tom DeLay deciding that he's not going to try to maintain his leadership of the House. He's going to back off, right? He says. I agree with the conventional wisdom in the news business that the senior Republicans, both in the House and the Senate, and probably at the White House, maybe this is just a decree that came down from Karl Rove or one of their pollsters or something. Who knows? But they basically told Tom DeLay, forget it, buddy, forget it. Try to hang on to your seat in Sugarland, Texas. If you can do that, we'll be impressed. But no, you're not gonna be the leader of the House of Representatives. Ain't gonna happen. And DeLay says, I'm leaving. So now who's gonna step up? Well, it looks like probably Roy Blunt. He's the number three guy right now anyway. And he's already, according to the Associated Press, rounding up support by telephone. Roy Blunt of Missouri. Maybe John Bonnier of Ohio. He also says he wants to be in there. And, a few others, Deborah Price of Ohio, Eric Cantor of Virginia. There's a few, Zach Wamp of Tennessee, who've said that, they'd like the job. But I'd say Roy Blunt is the most likely. And why? Because, let's just be candid about this. Roy Blunt is just as corrupt as Tom DeLay was. I mean, Roy Blunt is the guy who was having an affair with a lobbyist for one of the nation's largest tobacco companies. He later jettisoned his wife of some 30 years to marry this woman. But while he was having the affair with her, to quote the Center for American Progress, quoting, I believe it's the New York Times, he surprised his fellow top Republicans by trying to quietly insert a provision benefiting Philip Morris USA into the 475-page bill creating a Department of Homeland Security. Now, why would he do this? Well, turns out Philip Morris had just given him $150,000. Yes, bribery is illegal. Whether this is bribery or not, you know, who knows? And will he be prosecuted? Not as long as the Republicans control the House and Senate. In any case, several insiders, quote, privately expressed concern that Blunt pushed the provision partly because of his personal relationship with Philip Morris lobbyist Abigail Perlman, who is now, by the way, Mrs. Blunt. This scandal, notes the Center for American Progress, was kept secret for months because the White House and House leaders preferred, quote, no publicity on a matter involving favors for the nation's biggest tobacco companies and a company and possible claims of conflict of interest. Now that they're married, Blunt's son, Andrew, fresh out of law school, well, 4 years out of law school, gets a nice job doing what? Lobbying for Philip Morris. Gee, what a surprise. Blunt also has a PAC, just like Tom DeLay did. Now, Tom DeLay's PAC, Texans for Republican Majority, Trim PAC, is at the center of Tom DeLay's criminal indictment for money laundering. Roy Blunt's PAC, Rely on Your Beliefs Fund, R-O-Y-B, as in Roy Blunt, was until last year, run by a guy by the name of Jim Ellis. In fact, actually, yeah, well, last year, the year just turned, because Ellis was being paid as getting paychecks from Roy all the way up to July of 2005. Jim Ellis also had another job. He was running Texans for Republican Majority, Trim PAC. And he has now been criminally indicted for money laundering. This is the guy who ran Roy Blunt's PAC, the guy who has been criminally indicted for money laundering while he was running Tom DeLay's PAC. In fact, he was forced to sign a consent decree for ethics violations in the context of his running, this is in 2002, his running Roy Blunt's PAC, his Roy B. PAC. The Washington Post reports that Blunt, as majority whip, delegated, quote, authority to Washington Business and Trade Association lobbyists to help negotiate deals with individual House members, end quote. In other words, he's lining up relationships between House members and trade association lobbyists and business lobbyists. Excuse me, I didn't know that lobbyists and trade association members were supposed to be writing legislation. But they are, and a large part of the reason why they are is because of Roy Blunt. These lobbyists are now an integral part of the whip operation, on par with a network of lawmakers who serve as assistant whips. Center for American Progress goes on to add, Blunt's son collects hundreds of thousands of dollars in lobbying fees with Blunt's closest corporate allies. Blunt also cashes in on his corporate connections with luxury travel on company-owned jets. Washington Post reports that Blunt and House Majority Leader Tom DeLay are the top two users of corporate jets among the current leadership, together accounting for at least 140 trips during the past two election cycles, an average of one flight every 10 days. So this is the guy who's most likely going to take the place of Tom DeLay. Encouraging, huh? I think it is. I got to say, I find it encouraging. Because increasingly Americans are seeing the Republican Party for what it is. It is the reinvention of the aristocracy that the conservatives of the 1700s wanted. I mean, in the early 1700s, you had the conservatives in America before 1773. The conservatives in America were people who supported the king. They supported a hereditary aristocracy. After 1776, after the Declaration of Independence, and particularly after 1787, after the end of the War of Independence and the beginning of the writing of the Constitution of the United States, conservatives in America were still supporting an aristocracy. They just said instead of it being a lineage from one of the kings of Europe, the aristocracy should be an aristocracy of the rich, of the wealthy. They didn't like democracy. John Adams, for example, would quote Plato and Aristotle all the time, talking about how, you know, you just can't trust democracy. You've got to have a, there has to be some kind of an aristocracy. The conservatives have always believed. And the conservatives in America have, you know, in the early days they were called Federalists. The Federalist Party imploded. Then they became the Whigs. They imploded. Then it became the Republican Party. And it is till this day. And they've suggested that the natural aristocracy, the artificial aristocracy, excuse me, that they promote is an aristocracy based on wealth. And Jefferson and the other liberals have always argued, no, yes, you can have an aristocracy, but it should be a meritocracy. In other words, every generation you want the best and the brightest to step forward and participate in governance. You know, like Rhodes Scholars, like Bill Clinton coming forward and saying, yes, I'll run for president. It was very straightforward. Jefferson, on October 28th, 1813, after they're both elderly and out of office, he's writing a letter to Adams. And he says, I agree with you that there's a natural aristocracy among men. The grounds of this are virtue and talents. So this is Jefferson's position. Then he says there's also an artificial aristocracy founded on wealth and birth with neither virtue nor talents. And then he goes on to point out how he believes in the natural aristocracy. The natural aristocracy I consider is the most precious gift of nature. May we even say that that form of government is the best which provides the most effectively for a pure selection of these natural aristoi to the offices of government. Then he talks about Adams' artificial aristocracy based on wealth. He says it's a mischievous ingredient in government, and provision should be made to prevent its ascendancy. And then he just lays it right out. He says, on the question which is the best provision, you and I differ. But we differ as rational friends, using the free exercise of our own reason and mutually indulging its errors. And then he talks about how John Adams thought they should put all the wealthy artificial aristocracy into a separate chamber of legislation, the United States Senate. See, the Senate wasn't elected until 1913. It was appointed by the states. It was there to protect the interests of the rich because of the early conservatives in this country. And Jefferson goes on to say, nor do I believe them necessary to protect the wealthy, because enough of these will find their way into every branch of legislation to protect themselves. He said, with respect to aristocracy, we should further consider that before the establishment of the American states, nothing was known to history but the man of the old world, crowded within limits either small or overcharged and steeped in the vices which every situation generates. But even in Europe, a change has sensibly taken place in the mind of man. And he's referring to democracy starting to spread around the world. And, you know, he just comes right out and says it, actually, a little later, 3 years later, in a letter to Samuel Kershaw. He says, I'm not among those who fear the people. They, and not the rich, are our dependents for continued freedom. Well, the conservatives have historically disagreed, and that's why the Abramoff scandal is not an aberration. It is business as usual for conservatives. Because conservatives believe in this artificial aristocracy based on wealth and power, they believe it's the only way to keep the country stable. Now, to their credit, they actually believe that this is the best thing for the country. To the detriment of America, they're wrong. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Just got turned on to an incredible website by the folks in the chat room. By the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, just go to tomhartman.com and click live chat, and it'll drop you in there. BeyondDelay.org, website dedicated to the 13 most corrupt members of Congress. It's brilliant. Victoria Jones is with us with Talk Radio News Service. Speaking of corrupt members of Congress and their hearings and whatnot, they're talking to Sam Alito at the moment, right?
Yes, they are, and he's about to make his statement. I believe the people speaking for him are speaking now. I actually just got out of the White House press briefing where there were a number of topics on everyone's mind, a little bit of Alito, a little bit of Delay, but the vice president's foot was first foot forward, I would say. And I must say, if they wanted to create a secretive scandal, then this is the issue, because they will not tell us what's wrong with his foot. I even pressed them on it. And
you're talking about Dick Cheney?
Huh? Dick Cheney, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They won't tell us what it is. He was flat out asked, is it gout? He will not tell us. He refers everyone to the vice president's office. The vice president's office won't tell anybody what's wrong with the foot. I said, is it some weird dreaded infectious foot disease? And he wouldn't answer me.
You know, Victoria, if you look at Google Earth, you can see the details of the Pentagon. You can see the details of the CIA building. You can even see the details of the NSA building, the most super secret building in the United States. There is only one place on all of Google Earth that's actually blurred out on the Google Earth maps, and that's Dick Cheney's house.
Isn't that astonishing?
It's blurred out.
I drive past it every day.
Well, see, I think that this is I think this is why he's not saying what's going on with his foot, is because he just doesn't say. You know, he's obsessively secretive. You've got a guy who's got the mentality of Joseph Stalin in here as Vice President of the United States.
Well, you could be right. You could be right. But it just, if you want to make something an issue, then just refuse to answer everybody's questions, because
yeah,
he just made it an issue.
Yeah, it's well, we'll see how that plays out. I understand Teddy Kennedy just gave quite a speech about Alito. Were you in there, or were you at the White House at that time?
I was at the White House. I wasn't able to hear it. I'm sure that we'll be putting up some good sound from that. That's just a prelude, I think, to Ted Kennedy's real performance, which will be in the questioning.
Right. And we can catch all the audio for that over at talkradionews.com, as can our listeners. And we'll be getting some clips from that for the program for, you know, either later on today or for tomorrow.
One of the things that Scott was at pains to point out was that, you know, they want a dignified hearing. And he was pressed on this by David Gregory as to what that means, because really it's code for not asking any tough questions or pushing him.
Right.
But he of course, he wouldn't be drawn on that either. But it does seem as though if you disagree with him and push him on something or go after his integrity, then that's no longer dignified.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a sad day in America. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Any other hot news you want to share with us?
That's pretty much it. It's Alito, delay stepping down, and...
You think Roy Blunt's going to get the job?
I'm sorry?
Do you think Roy Blunt's going to get the job?
No, I don't, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not sure that he will. I think he's taken Abramoff money. I think he's too close to Abramoff. I think the other Republicans are going to want to move on.
Oh, that's very interesting. He's certainly proclaimed his willingness to do so, and he's out there launching a fairly public campaign to get the job.
I know. I mean, this is just my personal opinion based on nothing, but that's what I think. That's the sense I get.
So you think the Republicans are really starting to take this seriously, and they're really running scared as a result of
it? I think it's radioactive.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting, the whole Abramoff thing. Fascinating, the Teapot Dome scandal of our day.
Yes.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Jerry in Olympia, Washington on the line. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Heidi, hi, Tom. Hallelujah. How sweet it is to hear the words, bribery is illegal, and Democrats are not involved at all.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, this is, you know, just so for those of you who just tuned in, I just have to play this here, Jerry. This Howard Dean, this yesterday.
There are no Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff. Not one single Democrat. Every person named in this scandal is a Republican. Every person under investigation is a Republican. Every person indicted is a Republican. This is a Republican finance scandal. There is no evidence that Jack Abramoff ever gave any Democrat any money, and we've looked through all those FEC reports to make sure that's true.
So there's Howard Dean, the head of the Democrats. They're, you know, Dean's had a good spine all along. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Jerry, your point, your question, your comment.
Well, I'll tell you. I started out wanting to ask you one thing, and while I was listening to some of the information that you have available while you're waiting, I got my answer to the first question. But some time ago, the Supreme Court blocked labor unions from contributing to political campaigns and, you know, on a member by member basis. They said that a local became one vote, basically. So they,
right,
each local was limited in what they could contribute to a campaign. But they didn't do the same thing with churches.
Hmm.
And
interesting.
What I wondered is if labor unions could start calling themselves churches.
Churches.
There's a number of Buddhist sects that don't
there you go.
Involve any deity.
Yeah.
Just a philosophy and labor.
It's not going to be. It's an interesting idea, Jerry. I can see it now. The Church of the Gooey Death, Spiritual Brownie Point, and God's Stamp Redemption Center, right? 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Lather was 30 years old today. They took away all of his toys.
Oh, and they made him governor of Texas.
Sent newspaper clippings to him about his old friends who stopped being old.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes, 25 minutes before the hour. 35, 4 minutes past the hour. Coming up on 25 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. Senator Ted Kennedy just now saying Alito's record, quote, troubles me deeply, end quote. This from the blog over at the Washington Post, where they have the text of the entire thing online. He says, especially in the context of the president's spying program, he found Alito's deference to presidential authority especially troubling. He said, I'm gravely concerned by Judge Alito's clear record of support for vast presidential authority unchecked by other branches of government. I'm concerned, he said, about Alito's support for intrusions on individual privacy. And indeed, Ted Kennedy said he finds Alito's views frightening. He said, as I recall, it's 84% of the time Alito has ruled against the little guy, as it were. He says, and so Ted Kennedy points out, he says, average Americans have had a hard time getting a fair shake in his courtroom, Alito's courtroom. He points out Alito has not written in favor of a person of color. In fact, the whole speech is there, and it's rather lengthy and fascinating. So we'll see where this all goes. And Tom DeLay. Oh my! Tom DeLay was this over at the ThinkProgress.org blog. The only reason I was indicted was a massive conspiracy between Democrats, the district prosecutor, and 8 grand juries. Yeah, he's got these, this exclusive interview with Fox News yesterday. DeLay, Democrats used this runaway district attorney here in Austin, Texas, to abuse that rule. 8 grand juries indicted me. The only reason to indict me was to get me to step aside. So Randy Cunningham, Duke Cunningham, he has to leave, right, because he was bribed. And so he was on the Appropriations Committee, the House Appropriations Committee, a very powerful committee. So he leaves, and guess who's taking his place? The guy who leaves, Duke Cunningham, the Republican from Rancho Santa Fe, formally resigns from Congress after pleading guilty to bribery, accepting bribes. Who takes his place? Tom DeLay. Update. This from ThinkProgress.org. Contractor Brett Wilkes, known as co-conspirator number one in Cunningham's plea deal, has given $30,000 to DeLay, who flew on Wilkes' jet several times and has been a frequent golfing buddy. It just doesn't get any better than this, friends. I'm telling you. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Tom, my man. How are you?
I am great. What's up?
Hey, this is what I was going to talk about, but I really do think the time is ripe to really get some public discussion about corporate contributions to campaigns and lobbying.
Oh, yeah. The entire system is starting to rot from the inside. Not starting to. It has been rotting for some time. And frankly, I think that, we've had a series of Supreme Court decisions that go back to the late 70s that have brought corporations more and more into power and corporate power. I mean, you just didn't see this during the Eisenhower years. You didn't see it during the Kennedy. Even LBJ, even Richard Nixon was not this corrupt. I mean, it's
like a cancer.
It really is. And we have to do something to stop it. And some kind of meaningful campaign finance reform. And that has to begin by saying dollars are not votes, And, you know, go back to one person, one vote. Dollars are not votes, and corporations are not persons.
That's right. And y'all know if you've ever read this book, there's a book out there called Unequal Protection.
Yeah.
All about this
kind of thing. Yeah, I just happened to. Yeah, for those who don't know, I wrote that book. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. That's
thanks for the plug, Steve.
Hey, anyway, I was going to talk about fear. You know, it's all about fear. You know, my wife said to me the other day, she said, you know, the only one terrorizing us is Bush.
Well, he's got a whole lot of collaborators in the Republican Party and in the media, by the way, who are all just, you know, trumpeting the whole thing. And Cheney is a master at it. I mean, basically before the election, he said, if you vote for Kerry, the terrorists are going to get you.
I remember that. It was horrible. You know, this this past Christmas, you know, I basically ruined Christmas dinner, family dinner, you know, by bringing up, you know, asking everybody, you know, that's pretty, my wife's family's pretty conservative.
Oh, I wouldn't have done that, Steve.
I did it. I couldn't help it.
Yeah.
I brought up, I said, y'all think, you know, Bush is going to be impeached? And, you know, complete silence, except her mom said, you know, I think John Lewis should be impeached, who's one of our congressmen. I was like, what are you talking about? And, you know, she said as she was leaving the room that, you know, that he should be impeached for bringing up Bush's impeachment, and that if it's okay to spy on Americans as long as it's against the war on terrorism.
Yeah, and John Lewis is one of my heroes. I mean, he was one of the guys who was marching there with Martin Luther King in the early days. He was he's a good man.
He is a man's man.
Yeah.
Whereas Bush is not.
He's a good guy.
Last week, did you talk about George Gerbner?
Don't recall.
He died last week, and there was an editorial in the, or obituary in the New York Times about him, and he did all this research on violence and TV, and he talked about how fearful people are more dependent, more easily manipulated and controlled.
Oh, yeah. I remember his research. I didn't know that he died.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's all I got, Tom.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Steve. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Storm in Carbondale, Illinois, listening on WINI. Hey, Storm. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Tom, a while back, State Farm Insurance Company lost an enormous lawsuit here in Illinois, up to $1 billion lawsuit. Mm-hmm. They lost it. And so what they did was, during the last election, they financed the campaign of Judge Lloyd Carmire up to what I've heard is $1 million to install him in office. And he did win the election. That was the most money ever spent on a judicial election. In fact, 70% of his money came from out of the state. Also, Philip Morris had a lawsuit pending. So anyway, Judge Carmire is installed in the Illinois Supreme Court, and he's asked by news people, don't you think you should recuse yourself from this State Farm insurance case because you gave them so much money during the campaign? He says, nah, I can remain neutral on that.
Oh,
well,
geez.
Lo and behold, the case was reversed in the Supreme Court of Illinois.
With his vote.
Pardon me?
With his vote.
With his vote, saving State Farm insurance over $1 million, and it only cost them $1 billion, and it only cost them $1 million.
Yeah, and for those who don't do math fast, $1 billion is $1,000 million.
That's pretty good investment.
Then, 1,001 return on your investment.
Yeah, then more
very
recently,
good.
Philip Morris Tobacco Company had been sued because they had represented light cigarettes as not as harmful to your health as regular cigarettes.
Yeah.
And that was reversed also in the Illinois Supreme Court. They had also contributed $1 million to Lloyd Carmire's campaign.
Now, Storm, assuming, you know, I can't speak to this myself because I'm not familiar with the details of this at the, you know, at the Illinois level as apparently you are. So I can't, you know, attest to the veracity of what you're saying, but assuming that everything that you're saying is true, how are the people of Illinois responding to this and how is it being played in the Illinois media?
Well, I'm a news junkie, Tom. I'm not on the internet or anything, but just the radio and TV and newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was reported, it seems to me, just a couple times, and it was just dropped. By the way, Carmire is a Republican. I don't think that surprises anyone. But, I'm just amazed at how it was just brought up once or twice. And then, of course, around here, this is the Bible Belt, Southern Illinois. And so most of them are Republicans.
But you would think that anybody who identifies themselves as a church-going Christian or a synagogue-going Jew or whatever it may be, as religious, that they would be in favor of the little guy as opposed. I mean, you know, that's the essence of most religions, is being in favor of the little guy against the, you know, whether it's, you know, Moses against the Pharaoh or whether it's, you know, Jesus against the hypocrites who ran the temples.
Well, absolutely, but most of these conservatives, I believe, have been brainwashed by Limbaugh and Bort Squeeze down in Atlanta and those people like that.
Yeah.
And they believe that stuff. They're so naive, they think they're being told the truth.
Yeah, it's truly tragic.
You know, their one single issue, the flag burning or abortion or whatever.
Yeah.
Bibles in school or whatever. Those are their issues, and they don't think about the larger picture that we have facing us.
Yeah, and it really is. Storm, thanks a lot for calling and for raising that issue. I appreciate it. And for listening there on WINI in Carbondale, Illinois, one of our very first affiliates, just about 3 years ago. Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. You often mention that Americans are waking up to the Republican Party, but let's get real. The Republicans haven't been able to get elected to get Americans to vote for them since Reagan. And they know this is true, and that's why they've been actively corrupting elections, either through voter disenfranchisement or Reagan holding the hostages, and now through voter tampering through electronic voting. And so they know.
Yeah, in fact, I would say, Logan, if I could just rewind a little bit, I'd say Republicans haven't been able to get elected, you know, legitimately in a clean fight since Nixon.
Yeah, right. And they know they can't win in 2006, and they know that if they do lose in 2006, that they're all going to be put in prison. So what we're dealing with here, it looks like, is a coup. And I wonder why you don't use that kind of terminology when you're describing what's going on.
Well, because the coup – well, I'm not unwilling to say that I think that in the election of 2000 there was a coup. That, you know, that when the Supreme Court put George W. Bush into the presidency, when Al Gore actually got more votes in Florida, if you counted the entire state, when they stopped the counting, and they said that the reason they did was because to continue counting the vote. I mean, they came right out and said it. Read the Bush v. Gore decision. They came right out and said that if the count in Florida was to continue, it would cause irreparable harm to George W. Bush. Period.
Yeah, they said that because it was only a few counties. He didn't ask to get the whole place counted.
No, ultimately Gore was asking for the whole state to be counted.
Oh, he was. Okay.
And the lawsuit was not brought by Gore. It was brought by Bush. Lawsuit was brought by Bush to stop the recount of the state. But the bottom line here is, you know, what are we going to do about 06?
I just think that it's been thoroughly corrupted. I think that ultimately there's no hope. I mean, how?
No. See, that's what they want you to think, Logan. That's the whole point. I mean, that's why they do all this stuff. And I think that, frankly, people on our side who are out, you know, trotting out all these stories, and I talk about them here, but purely in the context of this is what they're up to, and not saying, and therefore we have to get active, are doing all of us a disservice. I have tremendous hope, Logan. People are waking up, and you and I are part of that. We have to keep waking up more people and getting them involved. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When you think back to biblical times, when Adam and Eve talked to that snake 6,000 years ago, when the world was created, it was hot back then too. Why do you think Adam and Eve were naked? See what I'm saying? I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. You know, you didn't hear Adam and Eve running around talking about emission standards or hybrid cars. In fact, Adam and Eve drove an excursion.
Cut. The game of the old Bible Belt ballyhoo. You bamboozled them. Forget your AWOL and your DUI.
Indeed.
You gave them a show that always pleases. Your friends claimed you were endorsed by Jesus. You razzle-dazzled them. Razzle-dazzled them,
yes, indeed, George. You done good. You razzle-dazzled them, but it ain't going to work any longer. I really see this thing melting down. Los Angeles Times reporting here, in a case that echoes the Jack Abramoff influence-peddling scandal, two Northern California Republican congressmen used their official positions to try to stop a federal investigation of a wealthy Texas businessman who provided them with political contributions, Representatives John D. Doolittle and Richard W. Pombo. Joined forces with former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay of Texas to oppose an investigation by federal banking regulators into the affairs of Houston millionaire Charles Hurwitz. This is in the Los Angeles Times. And Richard Pombo, probably one of the most anti-environmental members of the entire House of Representatives. It's just getting thicker and thicker and thicker. I mean, it's over the top, my friends. It's over the top. It is, I just, I, I, don't know how to say it beyond that. These guys, the corruption has become so obvious, so apparent, and so sickening. I mean, so many people are just so offended by this thing. And now, by the way, they're looking at another company, this from the New York Times today, having secured a guilty plea from lobbyist Jack Abramoff, this by Ann Kornblut and Glenn Justice. Prosecutors are entering a new phase of the corruption investigation in Washington, focusing on a lobbying firm that had even closer ties to Tom DeLay. The firm Alexander Strategy Group is of particular interest to investigators because it was founded by Edward A. Buckham, a close friend of Mr. DeLay's and his former chief of staff, and has been a lucrative landing spot for several former members of the DeLay staff, people who are directly involved in the case have said. The firm openly promoted the idea that it could deliver access to Mr. DeLay. So here we have basically a lobbying firm, the Alexander Strategy Group, that came into existence purely to provide access to Tom DeLay. You want to get to the hammer? Hire us. We just happen to be made up entirely of former DeLay consultants or former DeLay staffers. Alexander Strategy Group, by the way, paid Mr. DeLay's wife $115,000 in consulting fees while conducting business with Mr. Abramoff's firm. Mr. Abramoff also referred clients to Mr. Buckham. So DeLay's wife is making $115,000. DeLay's making a pretty good set. This is the guy, Chris Matthews, says, oh, he just has a middle-class lifestyle. Yeah, right. At one time, Americans for the Republican Majority, or ARMPAC, the leadership committee that raised money for Mr. DeLay, was run out of the offices of Alexander Strategy. Mr. Buckham also ran the U.S. Family Network, a self-styled grassroots organization tied to Mr. DeLay, that, according to the Washington Post, was financed almost entirely by clients and associates of Mr. Abramoff. I mean, it's starting to get very, very thick here. As Kornblut and Justice note in the New York Times, Alexander Strategy's name has also surfaced in the course of a corruption investigation that implicates the defense lobbyist Brent Wilkes, who is an unnamed co-conspirator in the criminal case against former Representative Randy Duke Cunningham. You'll recall Cunningham, the guy who says, yeah, he took bribes. Mr. Cunningham pleaded guilty in December to accepting $2.4 million in bribes from Mr. Wilkes and others. Mr. Wilkes' firm, Group W, also hired Alexander Strategy to do lobbying work, and Mr. DeLay used a plane partly owned by Mr. Wilkes. I mean, this is just incredible. Scandal swirling around the Alexander franchise. 24 lobbyists at its office in the waterfront in Georgetown. Dick Armey, the former Republican House Majority Leader who now works for the firm DLA Piper Rudnick Cary Gray and also clashed with Mr. DeLay in the House, invoked Charles Dickens, likening Mr. DeLay to Fagin and Mr. Buckham to the Artful Dodger and Oliver Twist. I mean, this is Dick Armey. Well, I mean, you know, he's not the best of friends, I'd say, with Tom DeLay. He says, Tom DeLay sent Buckham downtown to set up shop and start a branch office on K Street, Mr. Armey said. The whole idea was, what's in it for us? He says, that's what I thought at the time, and I've been seeing nothing in the way they've been conducting themselves since then to dissuade me from that point of view. You know about the K Street Project. The K Street Project was this whole effort that was put together by Rick Santorum in Pennsylvania. He's heading it up to make sure that you're a corporation, you got millions or billions of dollars, and you want to do some lobbying in Washington, D.C.? If you want to talk to Republicans, we will only talk to you if you hire a lobbying firm that only hires Republicans. In fact, if you're going to hire a lobbyist for yourself, for your own corporation, he better be or she better be a registered Republican, or you're not even going to get in the door. The whole K Street Project, the whole job of the K Street Project, is first you've got Congress corrupted by K Street. The K Street is the street in Washington, D.C. where all the lobbying firms have their offices. And then the K Street Project, Rick Santorum's little pet project, along with Tom DeLay and Bill Frist, but Santorum is running the thing. The whole project was to corrupt K Street, which was already corrupting Congress. I mean, it just doesn't get weirder than this, my friends. If this doesn't bring about an absolute revolt on the part of the American people to say enough already, then I just don't know what will. And we need to be spreading the word. You and me, every day.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Alec Dubrow is with us. He's the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, also known as ILCA. Their website, ILCAonline.org, ILCAonline.org. Hey, Alec, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. You know, I think I need a shorter title and organization.
Too many words there, huh?
Well, like Labor Co. or something like that. But no.
Yeah, we have with us Alec Dubrow. He's the big guy.
The big guy. Well, I'm on the air. Howard Stern's on the air. It's a battle, I tell you.
There you go. Actually, that's my line.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Alec, you wanted to talk about the strike at New York University and the rise of low-paid academic workers. I poked around the web a little and wasn't able to find much about this. What's the deal here?
Well, it's extraordinary that there isn't much because here's a fascinating thing I dug up, is that higher education is a major industry employing a million or more people as faculty and staff, many more than work in, say, mining or fishing in the United States. And a great many of them across the country, or a number of them anyway, are organized. That is, graduate students and adjunct professors. These are the people on the very bottom rung of teaching.
These are the, now they're also, you find a lot of the janitors and custodial staff and whatnot are also organized, but that's a different union.
Those are different unions.
In this case, you're talking about the bottom end of the top end of academia. That is to say, the bottom end of the white collar jobs.
Exactly. And, you know, if you've ever gone through such a period in your life as I have, trying to live like a grad student only goes for a short period
of
time.
Well, my son's doing it right as we speak, down at the University of Georgia. He's working on his master's degree, and he's putting himself through school by teaching.
Well, and the problem here is that I looked at this study, and that between 1987 and 95, the percentage of faculty that was full-time at universities went from two-thirds to less than half.
Because of cheap labor, like my son?
Well, it's because they're able to get defund the full-time positions.
Right.
It's not that your son's being a strike breaker. There wasn't anything to be done about it.
No, it was nothing like that. Certainly.
Adjunct faculty increased from 70 to 95, 10% a year, or 266% overall.
Adjunct faculty being a euphemism for basically students who are working as teachers lower prices than a professor would be paid.
Well, adjunct is even those who are professors, usually younger ones, but not always, who just teach a few classes, are not on a tenure track. And NYU, in an effort to break the union here, reclassified many of their grad student assistants as adjunct. Then claiming, you know, they didn't have any claim at all to being full-time workers. Now, the fascinating thing about this strike is that in 2000, the National Labor Relations Board said that grad students who teach and earn money were bona fide employees and could organize. In 2004, with the newly reorganized Bush NLRB, they simply reversed that decision and said, oh, they were wrong before. Those contracts are null and void, or they have no right to form a union, no guaranteed right. There was no reason why NYU couldn't continue to recognize the union. It didn't say you must get rid of it, but it said you could. So NYU decided, well, that's it. We don't want them anymore, and we're going to give them a substandard contract, give them 48 hours to approve it, and when they didn't, the fight began, and November 9th they went out on strike, and they're still on strike, and it's cold up there.
Hmm. Interesting. On November 9th.
That's
so
right.
So we're pushing 2 months now.
This is, the two-month date.
Yeah.
And it's, well, it because it's New York, it's perhaps drawn more attention than a strike of several hundred would in a less media-intensive location. But it has.
But it still has not gotten, I mean, you know, maybe this is a big story in New York, but I've seen nothing about it out here on the West Coast.
It may make that, but it has drawn a lot of support from the community. A lot of the professors have decided to hold classes off campus so they don't feel like they're crossing a picket line. And some of the high-profile professors like the writer E.L. Doctorow have said they're not going to work while this strike goes on.
Right, those who can afford to, those who
yes.
have the luxury of being able to, yeah.
Yes, of course. You know, right. I mean, and sure, plenty of people are just going to school as if it were normal and not observing this, but there's been a fair amount of support. And it's interesting in that this is, like I said, the only private university that had a grad students union. At the same time, 30 universities across the United States, all of them nominally public, have had organized grad students for a long time, and those schools didn't fall apart. Nothing terrible happened to them. University of Michigan, University of California, UMass, Iowa.
Right, but if you're a private university, you're basically a money-making enterprise, right?
You're a money-making enterprise, and you're subject to the National Labor Relations Board. The public universities, the state ones, are the province of the State Department of Labor. And for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, a lot of the states are not inclined to clamp down on unions or even to fight them. And it's academic at this point as to which university is public and private. Like Michigan only gets 10% of its money from taxpayers. The rest of it comes from fees, you know, alumni, corporate sponsorships, money-making operations, and the private universities get lots of taxpayer money.
And tuition, by the way. Let us not forget tuition.
I'm sorry?
And let us not forget the money that they get from tuition.
Not
insubstantial.
That's right. And one of the reasons why this is a broader issue of social equality is that it means that the people who can afford to go to college, go to grad school, and make their way through become more and more those who are richer.
Mm-hmm.
Students, like everyone else in the U.S., are accruing huge debts. And, you know, most of us can't afford to spend, you know, the first half of our working lives getting rid of this, you know, anvil of debt around our necks. But that's the cost of it.
Well, and the last budget reconciliation by the Bush administration would add $5,600 per year per student to that debt by allowing, by changing the way that the federal government subsidizes student loans and allowing the interest rates to rise.
Oh, that's fascinating. That I didn't hear.
Yep.
Well, all of these things add to the burden of grad students. And while we may kind of chuckle and say, you know, they're not really real workers, they are real workers.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, the workforce in the U.S. at this point is at least 60% what we call white collar in varying degrees, you know, this is the way it's going to go. It isn't simply factory workers or construction workers.
I've noticed in the last 20 years or so this incredible increase in the presence of lowly paid interns, just all these categories that just frankly didn't exist 30 years ago when I was starting out in you know, the labor market, maybe more than 30 years ago, and that they're everywhere now. Our quote for the day, by the way, this is attributed to Abraham Lincoln. A lot of folks think that it was not actually written by him, but it reflected his perspective. In any case, it's in many sources. He says, "I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. Corporations have been enthroned. An era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until the wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed." Are we there, Alec?
I thought George Bush said that.
No. No, no. Cause
are we there? Yeah. You know, some days we are, and some days we're not. It's something.
So to wrap this up, we just have a few seconds left.
Okay.
What can people do about the strike that's going on in New York? Or is this, you know, what should be our response?
Well, support them if you want to be able to organize. Well, go to their website. It's www.2110UAW. This is the UAW union. Or just go to UAW. You'll find your way there. If you're in New York, they have a big rally coming up January 26th. And support similar efforts in your community if grad students are trying to organize.
Yeah, and speak with Greg. I'm going to have a conversation with my son about this and ask him what's going on down there at the University of Georgia. And also check out ILCA online, ILCA online.org. I'm assuming you have a link off your homepage to this.
We will as soon as I get off this phone call.
Okay. We're talking to Alec DeBro, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA online.org. Alec, thanks a lot for being with us.
Take care, Tom.
Keep up
Bye-bye.
The great work, my friend. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. And our guest today is cosmic comic and noted uncommentator, Swami Beyond Ananda. Swami is the author of Swami for Precedent, P-R-E-C-E-D-E-N-T, a seven-step plan to heal the body politic and cure electile dysfunction. His website, wakeuplaughing.com, and if you have questions for the Swami, you can give us a call at 866-440-8466. Welcome, Swami. Oh, I got to push the right button here.
Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Well, and speaking of which, Swami, do you have predictions for the New Year?
Well, you know, actually, I don't make predictions because I don't want to lose my nonprofit status.
Profit, like P-R-O-P-H-E-T. Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know what things are like where you are, but down here in California, you know, you can actually sue your psychic if they're wrong.
Sue your psychic? How does that work?
Well, it's simple. If you're a sucker for a seer, and what the seer sees sucks, you can redress your grievance in a seer sucker suit.
No. I can see where you definitely want to avoid one of those. They've been out of fashion for years. So anyhow, no predictions?
Well, no, I have something better than predictions, though. It's called television, not to be confused with TV. You know that TV network CBS?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes I think that's what they all should be called, CBS.
CBS.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you're tired of seeing BS, turn off your TV and television instead.
There you go.
So if you don't like the old news, then I say let's make some new news.
Okay, Swami, some good news. Go ahead. Tell a vision.
Okay, my vision. My vision is that this year, 2006, is the year that we launch the American Evolution. That is where we the people, finally realize that we are the leaders we have been waiting for.
That sounds good to me. How do you start an evolution?
Well, by firing the first big shot. By re-electing the misleader.
Yeah.
Okay, now can I be blunt with you?
I have a feeling you're going to anyway. Go ahead. Fire away.
Well, look, there's a new saying, the truth shall upset you free. So here goes. While we're all focused on those planes that got hijacked, our country got lowjacked by a gang of gold-collar criminals and privatizing privateers. And when the overworld makes an unholy alliance with the underworld, we the people get squeezed in the middle. So, I mean, all of a sudden, just like that, they passed what they called the Patriot Act, which I say should be renamed the Eternal Insecurity Act. And just like that, the Constitution gets deconstituted, and all those founding fathers are replaced by one big brother.
You're starting to sound like Thomas Paine.
Well, no pain, no gain, huh?
Yeah.
But look, I say it's time for the 50 million of us who voted for regime change last time around to launch Operation Total Recall. Impeach the president, because this time The stains are blood stains.
Well said.
You know, there's nobody up there to fix it for us. This is a We the People do-it-yourself project. And maybe if the body politic builds enough muscle and gets strong enough, the true leaders will be able to stand on our shoulders. And now is the time. You know why?
Why?
Because it's too late to do it sooner. That's why.
Of course. Of course.
So I recommend all your listeners go to impeachpac.org and sign on to the Citizens Impeachment Commission.
Yeah, I have. So, yeah, okay. Thank you, Swami, for that. And, if you know, amazing. If anybody has a question for the Swami, he'll be with us for a few more minutes. I have a couple of questions, if you don't mind. You
okay.
mentioned gold-collar criminals. What do you mean by that?
Well, gold-collar criminals, those are the ones who have figured out how to collar the gold without getting collared themselves. And, you know, look at Tom DeLay in that whole situation. And, you know, you can't blame them. They figure, why should we pay taxes when we can pay the legislators directly and eliminate the middleman that way?
Yeah, it seems, though, that they are starting to get collared.
Yes, well, that's good. That's good. You know, in fact, I actually got a call from Tom DeLay, believe it or not, because I lived in Texas for a while. He called me up. He was a little bit concerned about maybe having to do some prison time.
Uh-huh.
And I gave him some advice. I said, look on the bright side. Don't think of it as going to prison. Think of it as you'll be living in a gated community.
Right. One of the issues I've been involved with is corporate personhood. Any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, if this was a National Enquirer headline, the headline would read, "World is being ruled by artificial life forms." Because
right.
if you think about it, the corporation is an artificial life form without heart or soul. That has only one purpose, and that is to make money at any cost. And so consequently, that is how the world is being ruled by these corporations. So if they want to be persons, then at least they should have a heart and soul implant.
Sounds like a good plan. This American evolution you talk about is going to take a strong body politic. How do you suggest we build that strength, Swami, beyond an
Well, first of all, I think that we need to create a field of truth because we've undergone truth decay in this country. Let's face it. We need to build a field of truth and continue to tell the truth, and I call it pumping ironies, these contradictions that the press seems to miss. Like, how about this one? Two men lying together is an abomination, but when a whole bunch of men lie together, it's an abomination, that's apparently okay.
Yeah, as Bush did. Brilliant. Brilliant. Swami Beyond Ananda, the website Wake Up Laughing. He's the author of the new book, The Swami for President, P-R-E-C-E-D-E-N-T, a seven-step plan to heal the body politic and cure erectile dysfunction. Thanks, Swami.
Thank you, and may the farce be with you.
And you too.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Your swift boat liars, you would carry. Who risked his life while you withdrew? And now you're putting kids in harm's way. Does your conscience bother you? Tell the truth.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's time for our best of the rest of the news segment, looking back at last week's news, looking forward at this week's news, looking at what's happening right now. We have with us Mark Crispin Miller, an activist for voting reform and author of the book The Fooled Again, The Theft of the 2004 Election and How They'll Steal the Next One Unless We Stop Them. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And also Sarah Van Gelder, who is the executive editor and co-founder of Yes Magazine, the website yesmagazine.org. Hey, Sarah.
Hi.
Great to have you both here with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Sarah, I'm wondering, what's your take on the biggest story that's happening right now?
Well, you know, I think the corruption of the that's been highlighted by the Abramoff scandal is certainly one of the big stories. And it's interesting to see that the Republicans have rediscovered bipartisanship now that they're looking for who to blame for that scandal. But I think the big question that we're going to be looking for is, will Congress do anything more than come up with some Band-Aids? Will they actually look at the structural questions of how corporate money, big money, is attached to campaigning when it costs $2 billion for, you know, for people to run their campaigns.
Well, there's a larger question, isn't there, Sarah? And that is, can they? I mean, you've got Supreme Court decisions like Boston versus Bilotti that basically, you know, ratified the Santa Clara decision, saying that corporations are persons and therefore you can't take away their right to free speech.
Well, that's certainly a whole issue that needs to be addressed. But actually, several states have passed clean election laws that give candidates the option of running clean, the option of getting public campaign financing mm-hmm. in exchange for not accepting the big money. Maine and Arizona are two examples of that.
Right.
And one of the interesting things that's happened as a result is that, you know, you have stories of, you know, top members of the legislature when the lobbyist walks up to them and says, you know, did you run clean? They say yes, and the lobbyist turns his back and walks away because he knows he doesn't have any hold over those members of the legislature.
Yeah, but the flip side of that is
people for their campaigning.
The flip side of that is, though, because you can't absolutely ban not participating because of these constitutional questions that have to do with political free speech, and perhaps legitimately so. For example, here in Portland, Oregon, the Portland City Commission passed a clean elections law, and all of the city commissioners have said that they're going to run, you know, with the city money, and they're not going to take any contributions, blah, blah, blah. And a woman who actually was a progressive has come along with some money from the outside, and she's like, I'm not going to play by those rules. And she has targeted one of the city commissioners and intends to blow him out of the water. Very progressive guy. And all of a sudden, she's now, you know, kind of working on the corporate side. She's gone to the dark side.
Yeah, it's not perfect. I think what your earlier statement about dealing with corporate personhood really needs to be dealt with, because then we can deal with some of the First Amendment questions and make clear that it's people that are persons, not corporations.
Yeah.
But it is helpful, and some of the results are already showing up in that Maine and Arizona have been two states that have been able to make some progress on health care reform, you know, when the rest of the country, certainly nationally, they've been totally stymied by what people, you know, everywhere realize is one of our top crises.
Mm-hmm. Good one. Sarah Van Gelder, the executive editor and co-founder of Yes Magazine, yesmagazine.org. And you folks do a great job of identifying the areas of hope for us all. I really appreciate that. Mark Crispin Miller, I'm curious what your take is on the biggest story right now.
Well, first of all, I agree with everything Sarah has said. I think that this scandal is a little bit different from previous such scandals in that it is probably linked very closely to the theft of the 2004 election. Or let's put it this way, it has everything to do with the Republican Party's attempts to create a permanent majority for itself, despite the fact that its agenda actually does not appeal to a majority of the population. I think the Republican Party's plans, its program is so alien to the American people that it has really had no choice but to use extraordinary means of all kinds to seize power and to increase its power. These illegal maneuvers have a great deal to do with the current set of scandals. For example, Tom DeLay's gerrymandering of the state of Texas, it was like a little laboratory experiment to see what could be done at the national level. Because as Texas goes in this sense, so goes the nation. What I'm trying to say here is that the effort to sort of subvert the will of the electorate in Texas is crucial to that aspect of the DeLay scandals. And likewise, the DeLay program to turn K Street into a permanent right-wing monopoly to prevent members from the Democratic Party or givers to the Democratic Party from doing any business with politicians in any way, all of this is all about subverting democracy. And what I want to see is for the investigators here to look deeply into the scandal, just to take a look at how much of that money ended up in the coffers of politicians, how much of that money ended up being used to pay for various off-the-books activities in 2004. I think this is just the tip of the iceberg and has everything to do not just with the eternal fact of corruption in Washington, D.C., but more frighteningly with one party's attempt to make itself permanently dominant.
Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media studies, activist for voting reform, and author of Fooled Again. MarkCrispinMiller.blogspot.com, by the way, your website. Sarah, I'm wondering if you know, Mark raises this issue of electoral corruption and theft, and you're talking about corruption. And yet we saw, for example, when the first ethics charges were brought against Tom DeLay, that he was successful in changing the rules of the House, in getting evicted from the House Ethics Committee, Republicans who he didn't think were sufficiently loyal to him, and replacing the head of the House Ethics Committee with Doc Hastings from Washington State, who is basically a Tom DeLay toady, and in my mind equally corrupt or highly corrupted, badly corrupted. Where's the, you know, what's coming out of all this? Where do you see this going? Do you think that there actually will be significant investigations? They've been, it seems so far, been successful in preventing them.
Well, there seems to be an interesting woman working at the Justice Department. Her name slips my mind, but she seems to be actually interested in pursuing this. So we have yet to see how far this will go and whether it'll turn into a political game. But the other part of it is what, you know, I think that the big question I'm going to be looking at is what's going to happen in the election. Are the American people going to notice that this level of corruption has really reached perhaps a new high and make some different choices in November? And I think a lot of that will depend not only on whether Democrats are successful in distancing themselves from this particular scandal, but whether they're willing to show some vision about a different way of structuring how campaign funds are raised and what kind of direction this country might take and distance itself somewhat from the corporate agenda if we're going to see Americans being able to really make any distinction between these two political parties.
Well said. But Mark Crispin Miller, if one reads your book, Fooled Again, as I have, I certainly get the sense that the election of 2004, the people did speak, and what they said was, we want John Kerry to be president by a majority of perhaps millions, and that there was a concerted effort on the part of the Republicans to disenfranchise people that took the form of, you know, old-fashioned stuff like not enough machines, long lines, simply purging people off the voting rolls inappropriately so that they, when they showed up, they couldn't vote, sending them to the wrong place, all kinds of Republican dirty tricks, setting up phony, register here places, a corporation that was traveling all around the country, registering voters, and if you registered as Democrat, they threw away your registration, so when you showed up to vote, your name wasn't on the rolls. Not to mention the possibility that machines themselves might have been rigged or hacked. If the will of the people is, in November of 2006, throw the bums out, and the bums don't get thrown out, what do we do?
Well, that's what I think has happened, and that's the fear that I think we would do well not to suppress. I mean, indeed, the upcoming election is crucial, and indeed, it's very important that the American people get it. I think the American people got it last time, and I think that all the evidence bears me out on that. The question is, if the American people get it and vote on the basis of their having gotten it, and yet the system keeps stumbling along robotically on its own.
Well, I mean, the exit polls last time showed, in 2004, showed that John Kerry won by about 5 million votes, whereas the electronic voting machines told us that George Bush won by 3 million votes.
Machines that in at least 11 states, Tom, systematically flipped Kerry votes into Bush votes, and I have not heard of any machines doing that to Bush votes. Maybe it happened, I just don't know about it. No, this is look, whatever issues we're involved with as progressives, as conservatives, whatever it is, as Americans, no issue is more important than the integrity of the election system. If the party in power can successfully subvert the will of the electorate, then it can act with impunity, and that's what we've been seeing. I mean, this is hardly an administration that bothers to do much to try to palliate popular desire. The contempt with which they treat the public will is really kind of amazing. And I don't think they would behave that way if they didn't feel that they had a lock on the system. So DeLay's arrogance, you know, in basically manipulating the ethics committee and saying he won't step down, all of this, that's just one guy doing what the whole party tends to do. Because the whole party has no real interest in what the people want.
Well, and hopefully we can Well, hopefully we can do something about that. I mean, this is why it's a great idea to be contacting your member of Congress now and also your Secretary of State and your local election officials.
Absolutely.
And saying, enough, we want clean elections. Mark Crispin, Miller.blogspot.com, Fooled Again, his book. Sarah Van Gelder, Yes Magazine, yesmagazine.org. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here with us today.
Thank you.
45 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And there's an issue that has come to my attention, the issue of the so-called global warmings that are happening on our planet. For centuries, the rays of the sun have warmed the surface of our Earth's crust. And apparently those rays are intensifying in such a way that it's increasing lava flows. And,
cut!
I'm not gonna lie to you, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
Your razzle dazzle them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And the force, Fred, just lest we forget, 81 of the 550 people in Guantanamo Bay are now being force-fed. They're on a hunger strike. Many of them are in what are called five-point tie-downs. It's where their arms are tied down, their legs are tied down, their head is tied down. And they are being force-fed through tubes pushed down their nose. To quote David Rose in today's Observer in the UK, they routinely experience bleeding and nausea, according to a sworn statement by the camp's chief doctor, by our concentration camp's chief doctor, seen by the Observer. It is painful, Edmondson admits. This is Captain John S. Edmondson, commander of Guantanamo's hospital. Although non-narcotic pain relievers such as ibuprofen are usually sufficient, sometimes stronger drugs, including opiates such as morphine, have had to be administered. Interestingly enough, last week President Bush signed into law a measure removing detainees' rights to file habeas corpus petitions in U.S. federal courts. This, in my opinion, in violation of the Supreme Court. And Article 5 of the 1975 World Medical Association Tokyo Declaration, which U.S. doctors are legally bound to observe through their membership in the AMA, says that doctors must not undertake force feeding under any circumstances. Yesterday, Germany's chancellor, newly elected chancellor Angela Merkel, became the latest leader to condemn the United States for practices in the concentration camp at Guantanamo Bay. 1-866-440-8466. Susan in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Susan, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you. My question is, from 1925 till 1972, we had the Corrupt Practices Act, and one of its aims was basically to prevent corporations from buying the government. Why can't we demand to have that back? And I'll take my answer off the line.
Well, before you go off the line, Susan, I'm familiar with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which was passed in 1977 and has since been amended twice to accommodate treaties that we've signed that prevents agents of foreign powers from corrupting U.S. politicians, which raises the question, when Halliburton reincorporated Kellogg, Brown, and Root in the Cayman Islands so they didn't have to pay taxes on the money they made in Iraq, are they now subject to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act? But I don't think that we have a Corrupt Practices Act any longer in the United States, do we?
No, it was repealed in 1972.
And it was repealed because of a, wasn't it repealed because of a Supreme Court act? Or was it
We all know. That's my question. I wonder why we can't have that back.
Well, Susan, I'm going to have to look into that. I honestly don't know the answer to that question, so let me see what I can find out, okay?
Because it sure seems like an excellent idea to me. We had it for almost 50 years.
Yeah.
Now it's gone.
Yeah, it does seem like a good plan. The 70s were when the Federalist Society really started pushing a lot of these cases into the Supreme Court to raise corporate personhood and diminish the power of we the people. And I suspect that it may have had to do with the Supreme Court ruling that knocked it down. But I just, you know, that's just a guess, so I'm going to have to find out. Thank you, Susan, for the call. I'll track that down. In fact, David's writing it down right now. We'll get on it and find out. Tom in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Well, pleasure to speak to you, Tom. I'm out here in Washington State, and we have an initiative promoter called Tim Iman, and what he has done is basically taken the will of the state of Washington and forced the legislature to respond to it. So my question is...
How so? What do you mean?
For example, we have a car tab initiative where the age of the car and the value was the predicating dollar amount for the taxation associated, and he implemented a $30 flat tax for all vehicle tabs.
Right.
It went to the public to vote, and we voted to approve it. And we, from an initiative based, now have the state of Washington responding to the residents of Washington.
In a way, I mean, this is the problem with the initiative process. And that is that, you know, it literally is the problem of democracy that Aristotle and Plato wrote about and that John Adams quoted. And that is that, you know, it's the old Lincoln thing. You can fool some of the people all of the time. And for example, we had something similar here in Oregon, you know, which was marketed as, you know, you don't want the granny to lose her home because property taxes are going up. But in fact, it was a power grab by big developers. And you know what you're talking about is a situation where it's like, hey, if you're really wealthy and you got a very expensive car, you don't want to have to pay a higher tax than somebody who can't afford who's got a less expensive car. In other words, doing away with progressive taxation. But I'm sure it wasn't sold that way as doing away with progressive taxation.
Correct. My question is, sir, is that if the American populace said to the Congress and our representatives that we as the people want the same health care benefits that you extend to your own families, and in the next 12 months we want that implemented.
Right.
Wouldn't that just illustrate that the government is not responding to us, and then these average...
Well, it would. First of all, members of Congress, employees of many more enlightened corporations, simply have health insurance. So, you know, Bernie Sanders, the guy who's on this program every week, has Blue Cross Blue Shield. I mean, that's what's available to members of Congress. But that's also not available to a lot of Americans. So I agree with you. We should say to members of Congress, everybody should have what you have. But the other problem, and perhaps a bigger problem, is that while you have the initiative option in the state of Washington, we have the initiative option here in Oregon, you have it in California. This came out of the populist reforms in the 1880s. There's no initiative option at the federal level. We have to reelect. We have to elect people we can trust. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.